from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Mina Kim. This week's hot weather and red flag warnings reminded all of us that fire season is once again upon us. When homes burn down, fire victims and local officials often want to rebuild as quickly as possible. But in light of climate change, the question is being asked, is it time to stop building in areas at high risk for fire? This hour, we examine the idea of so-called managed retreat, backing away from rebuilding in areas prone to destruction by floods or wildfires. We'll get started right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Mina Kim. Well, summer is just about here officially, and that means the risk of wildfires is also upon us. Last year's devastating fire in Paradise destroyed 90% of the buildings there, thousands of homes gone. There and in other disaster areas like Sonoma and Mendocino, the question is what to do now? Rebuild homes that are more resistant to fire, tougher building codes, or just back away from rebuilding altogether, minimizing the risk of putting homes back in the line of fire? It's an issue KQED is examining as part of our series Living with Wildfire. And joining us to talk about it is Molly Peterson, our first guest, science reporter for KQED News. And Molly, you've been exploring this idea of managed retreat. What is that?
Well, managed,
sounds very scientific.
It did, very scientific. Brian Watt the other day said it sounded like fencing. Retreat isn't a word anyone's using related to fire. They're using it related to floods in other parts of the country. After Katrina, we talked a little bit about this, and there's been this transformation in how people respond to these disasters that are periodic, right? So because climate change and because people's responses to building infrastructure and responding to climate change are affecting the periodicity, the frequency of flood and fire. And I talked to a professor at UC Davis who says, you know, it's that 1-2 punch when we have disaster after disaster, that people's mindsets begin to change and ask a broader set of questions. So we are just asking questions. We're not suggesting that people need to, you know, immediately be herded off of their land and move. But when you talk about managed retreat, there's a range of solutions you can have, moving away from the edge of the wildland-urban interface, maybe incentivizing people to develop differently, re-examining our whole planning process. So there's a range of things that we can consider now in California.
And when it comes to floods, of course, with rising sea levels, I mean, if the land is underwater, I mean, you can't build there. Whereas with a fire risk, it's more kind of future, in the future, down the road possibility, right? So you think about it differently, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, there's a professor at UC Santa Barbara, Max Moritz, who talks about how we map fire hazards. So we talk about like the length of flames or the steepness of canyons. We don't always map what our evacuation routes are or how dense the housing is in these places. And if we put both our hazards and our vulnerabilities together, we'll have a better picture of what our risk is and we can understand it and plan for it.
And so at this point, is it just sort of theoretical or are some of these ideas actually being proposed in a way that local communities are thinking about and voting on or talking about in city councils and boards of supervisors?
Well, you cover politics so much, so you understand how planning is very much sacrosanct at the local level here in California. There's some discussion. Governor Newsom was on the job like 12 hours in and was talking about maybe the state gets involved and incentivizes better planning if we're not going to do it well. So it's in the ether. Are there specific proposals? Not necessarily. But at the Cal Fire level in the last few years, they've done some land use management, some kind of land use analysis, right? It's not mandatory. They advise local general plans, and local general plans can take this into account, you know, what that actually means, whether it'll work, we'll see.
Yeah, and as you said, this idea of command control from Sacramento on down, a lot of resistance to that. Incentivizing is a nice way to encourage local governments to do, quote unquote, the right thing. But is there a reluctance in Sacramento, do you think, to try to impose things that maybe everyone knows should be done to protect not just lives and property, but to stop shelling out all this money for homes that are destroyed time and again as we get into, you know, wildfire season every year?
I mean, I think that's more on the table than it has been in the past. We often rely on former fire chiefs to say the very hard things to us, right? Because the fire chiefs say, well, yeah, that was a bad idea. Don't build there. There's a guy in Los Angeles, Joe Edmiston, who's been at the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy forever. In 1992, he started saying three strikes and maybe don't rebuild where you are. So we're starting to talk about this. That guy, Max Moritz at UC Santa Barbara, he's talked to these local planners, and they will tell him, not by name and not for publication, that they're worried about what we're doing. And so if people are sounding alarms like that, that's a concern.
Well, and to a certain extent, aren't insurance companies sort of doing this for people, saying, look, we're not going to insure that anymore?
Right. And that's often what government people say, right? Like, look at the private market's making these choices, but we can also make these choices differently. Something we know with floods is when you spend $1 before to mitigate some risk or plan better, you're saving $4 to $6 on the back end. There's something similar for fire.
We're talking about what to do in the face of wildfires and whether or not to rebuild or where to rebuild. Talking with Molly Peterson, a science reporter for KQED News. She's been reporting on this as part of our series looking at living with wildfires. I want to bring in some other guests right now. Dan Essef is the district manager for the Paradise Recreation and Park District. He joins us from up there in Butte County. Dan, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
And also joining us, Pete Parkinson. He's former director of the Sonoma County Planning Department, also former president of the California chapter of the American Planning Association. Pete Parkinson, welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
And Timothy Inglesby, Executive Director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. Welcome to you.
Hey, thanks.
Dan, SF up there in Butte County, let me ask you about what's happening there on the ground now. What are people talking about in light of the devastation there in terms of rebuilding?
You know, I think it's absolutely fascinating to watch how things have shifted for our community as far as we've had a very well-educated for fires and evacuations, but the whole conversation is really going to a whole different level now. And so, you know, I think it's opening up some ideas that may have sat on the shelf in the past. I know that for our district, we're looking at some concepts of how parks can provide buffers, protection, defensible space for the entire community. But I think what's really interesting about this, and you touched on this a bit, is the scale is not only state and national, but there's landowner responsibility and everywhere in between. And so for us to adequately adapt and, get used to living in a fire landscape is that we need to have all of those pieces together.
You know, a lot of people, a lot of people after the fires there moved to, I think, Chico, which saw a big spike in population. Is it your sense that people, as part of these, you know, conversations that are happening, are thinking, I'm just not going to go back, I don't want to rebuild? Or are they thinking more, I want to build in a different part, but still basically in the same community?
You know, I think the numbers have shifted a bit, but what I would characterize it as is it's basically a third was, set on rebuilding and working through that process. A third is definitely not going to, and a third is sitting in the middle and watching it. And I think that wobbles a little bit as we proceed. What has been very fascinating to me is the Town of Paradise has sponsored a recovery project. So this is getting citizen input. And even though we don't have people in this zip code right now, hundreds of people have participated in this. So they've come out from wherever they've been relocated right now to provide input on how to improve the community. So they're very invested in what happens here. And I think, frankly, that what works in Paradise and what solutions we have implications for the entire state.
And Dan, I think you have a plan to buy up property to create that kind of a buffer. Can you talk about that? What's your thinking?
Yeah, and it's not just purchases. It could be other agreements or easements, that type of thing. But I think what's really clear on a lot of these communities that were developed, you know, our roads were developed in the gold rush as far as the alignment of them. And in many cases, our homes were built in the 40s and 50s and 60s. When, Smokey the Bear ruled and we could prevent forest fires. And we know that after 8 years or more of fire suppression, that strategy isn't going to work. And fires are on a different scale and intensity. And looking at communities, there are areas that are entirely vulnerable. And we talk about the wildland-urban interface. In Paradise, to a large extent, that wildland-urban interface was a wooden fence that was in someone's backyard instead of an area that could be managed for fuels and fire breaks. And frankly, for our community to survive, I think us having a recreation backbone to the community will allow us to have a sustainable economy and help pay for some of the other efforts on the land management side of things.
That's Dan Essef. He is the district manager of the Paradise Recreation and Park District. Let me bring in Pete Parkinson now, former director of Sonoma County's Planning Department. And Pete, you recently wrote an article basically, I don't want to say apologizing, but acknowledging that some of the decisions that have been made by planners were maybe a little short-sighted. Tell us about your thinking there.
Sure. Well, let me start by mentioning that in the October 2017 fires here in Sonoma County, my family lost our own home, and so we're in the process of rebuilding, and this has given me a really kind of unique perspective on all of this. But the perspective that I think fire protection agencies and planners and elected decision makers have taken about land use decisions in wildfire hazard areas in the past has been, here's a set of standards. They call them the fire safe standards in the California law, as well as the building code standards for the wildland urban interface. Here are the standards. Go ahead and build. We can protect you in these areas. And I think that is really turning out to be a fallacy in some areas, because with these wind-driven wildfires that have embers going out a mile ahead of the fire front and catching additional buildings on fire, which then catch more buildings on fire, which then actually catches the trees on fire at that point, it's really unrealistic. And we need to be looking a lot harder at where future development goes in the state of California. And I do want to kind of tag on to something that Molly was talking about at the outset about the sacrosanct nature of local land use decisions. And while that is true, all of the individual land use decisions about where development goes are made at the local level, it is the state government that really sets the framework for that. And so that's why you see bills in the legislature right now that strengthen the planning requirements and actually have planning mandates, not just advisory guidelines in there, for paying much closer attention to wildfire hazards and getting very specific about the actions that local governments would need to take if they're going to continue approving subdivisions in the wildland urban interface area. So I think it's a very important step forward. And we talked at the beginning about managed retreat. As Molly mentioned, that isn't really talked about at this point in terms of wildfire hazards. And I think one of the reasons for that is that we know that there is so much more that we can do short of that to help protect our communities and protect individual homes. And one of the things that we've learned here in Sonoma County as we look at how to make development safer in the future is this concept of starting at the house and working outward. So new homes that are built in these areas are going to be much harder and much more resistant to ignition than the homes that were there before the fire, but even the homes that are still there can be hardened. They can be retrofitted with hardening measures, and the landscape can be managed in a way that does help reduce fire hazard. It's certainly not going to eliminate it, but I think we've learned a lot about how to manage those landscapes and about how to make the buildings themselves more resilient.
That's Pete Parkinson, former director of Sonoma County's Planning Department. And Pete, I want to quote from the article you wrote that I referred to a moment ago. And you wrote, "We plan for what we can envision. It turns out our vision was insufficient. As planners and local government decision makers, we thought we had adequately anticipated the hazards and had planned accordingly. We were wrong." What did you miss, looking back on it?
Well, I think we missed the magnitude and scope of it. So we plan for wildfire hazards. And in fact, if you look, the city of Santa Rosa had done an analysis of the wildland urban interface areas around the city of Santa Rosa, and they had identified the vulnerable areas. This is back 15 years ago, so well before the fires that we had here. And if you look through that report about wildfire hazards facing the city of Santa Rosa, virtually every area that burned in the 2017 fires was identified as a vulnerable area in that plan. And there were vegetation modification prescriptions and whatnot in there to help reduce that hazard. What that plan did not envision was all of these vulnerable areas going up at once. And that's what happened in October of 2017, is that instead of having a fire in the Fountain Grove neighborhood, for example, you had one in Fountain Grove, you had them on the west side of the 6-lane 101 freeway, you had them in my neighborhood down in Sonoma Valley. So you had multiple separate fires that went off at the same time, all driven by these extraordinarily strong winds that just immediately overwhelmed the firefighting infrastructure, overwhelmed the communication infrastructure, and ultimately resulted in the outcome here, which was 5,300 homes lost in the county of Sonoma.
And Pete, it sounds like what you were describing earlier is, you know, we think of the trees catching fire and then the houses catching fire, but it sounds like it was a little bit of the other way around, where the houses would catch fire and then embers from the homes would land in the forest.
Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, I didn't really even know this myself until just a few months ago, but if you talk with the folks at Cal Fire about the fire state standards that were adopted in the early 1990s, you know, that are things like defensible space and water supply and whatnot, the purpose of those was to protect the forest from the fires that would originate at homes that were put out there. And so, you know, there are studies out there now, and maybe Molly can speak to some of these, that have shown that the number one indicator of fire hazard in the wildland area is the density of residential development. So we're really, when we put additional homes in these wildland areas, we're literally adding fuel to the fire. We're putting additional ignition and fuel sources in these areas that make the fires more intense and, you know, like you described, end up catching the forest on fire. I mean, we had trees on our property that would not have burned except for the fact that our house burned down.
Interesting. Molly Peterson, the notion that, you know, we think of density as being a good thing, but not so much in these areas.
Yeah, and what we know about density is still emerging in these studies. So it turns out very high density and relatively low density are, you know, it's the moderate density that actually so far they're finding is kind of a very high risk thing. But I want to sort of address this broader community level point. You know, we're expanding this wildland urban interface. There's more miles where we're at a seam with these risky areas. We're moving more and more people into that area. And there's one study that projects that we could have as many as 600,000 to 1.2 million more homes by mid-century in this area.
Isn't that something that we could, like, put the brakes on?
Well, I mean, to Pete's point, I mean, about this tension between local, you know, state and local, we have building codes, right? There are things that we are doing, but we're not necessarily, we don't have some sort of codified state guidance about where communities can get sited. So we know there are these high-risk areas, and we put houses there.
Isn't there a new state law that I think just took effect, which requires more oversight and approval for local plans by the state fire and forest protection agency?
And it's not that it doesn't have any teeth. It's that a lot of counties just approved their general plans. So it's not going to come up for a while in that process. All that mandates, too, is a consultation with these fire officials. And so far, the people in those consultations say that they're going well and they're responding to them. But if a county says, you know what, we have to prefer something else because we need a tax base, we need housing in these areas, I don't know that there's anything to stop them.
Timothy Inglesby, I want to bring you in, Executive Director of the Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. As a firefighter and your organization, where do you see this conversation and the ways in which fire departments, Cal Fire and others, are going about both protecting homes and buildings and people and also preventing these things from happening?
Well, I want to commend my fellow guests here. They've made many good points. But implicit in all the development to date and all the planning to date is that we rely on firefighters to, you know, attack wildfires and put them out. And that's ultimately the backstop for how we're dealing with fire. The scale, I think, as Pete mentioned, is immense. This is a societal issue, not just a state issue or a local issue. And I believe it's like 40% of the housing units are located in the WUI zone. So we're not going to be able to have this, what the right wing believes is a rural depopulation strategy to remove people. This is where they're at. But, we can take simple and low-cost, high-effective steps to make homes more fire-safe. And that really is the issue. Because you could argue that the entire state of California is fire-prone. And so, if you move them from one area, they're going to move into another area, from the frying pan into another fire zone. So what we have to enable is to allow fires to, keep fires in wildlands, in ecosystems where they belong, where they have many benefits, and keep them out of communities and home zones. And so it's best that we start from the homes, work outward in kind of sequential manner, and ultimately get to that point where we have what you might call a fire-permeable landscape. Fires can safely move across, wildland areas and move around and not within homes and community areas. And we have the technical knowledge and tools to enable that to happen. We're just lacking the political will to make it happen.
Is there any discussion among firefighting groups like yours that perhaps firefighters are putting themselves at too much risk in trying to help and rescue people who have been warned, either don't move there or get out now, but decided to stay?
Oh, definitely. There's a lot of talk within the community about that. This concept of suicide subdivisions, that high density housing and that access through a narrow winding road, one way in, one way out, inadequate water supplies, no ability for engines to enter. With people flooding out, they can't enter in, maneuver, and so they're kind of applying a triage model of individual homes that are just completely unprepared, neighborhoods that are equally, dangerous, and firefighters are just unwilling now to attempt the impossible, if
yeah.
you will.
Yeah, absolutely. Molly?
Well, we are creating those vulnerabilities still in these wildland areas. I went to a place called Harmony Grove in San Diego where that happens, where there's just one way in and out, and we're still building those houses right now.
All right, much more to talk about. Dan, FSF, I know you need to leave, but I want to thank you very much, and best of luck to you and the folks up there in Paradise in the coming months.
Thank you so much.
I want to give out the phone number before we get to the break. It's 866-733-6786. If you want to join this conversation, we'd love to hear from people who maybe made a decision whether or not to rebuild after a fire and what went into that. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim. Much more to come. Hope you stick around. Welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today, and for the rest of this hour, we're going to continue our conversation about rebuilding after wildfires in areas that are at high risk for wildfire. Joining us, Molly Peterson, science reporter for KQED News. Also, Pete Parkinson, former director of the Sonoma County Planning Department, and Timothy Inglesby, executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. And I say goodbye to Dan Efsef from Paradise, the Recreation and Park District there, but he's still with us. And Dan, there's something you wanted to add. I think it was about maybe access in and out of some of these communities. Go for it.
I just wanted to the guest comments on some of these political boundaries that are really difficult to overcome. I think in our community, because of the fire, has had erased some of those. And so, some of these concepts when I mentioned the parks concept here, we're looking at some of these acquisitions and easements as actually help connecting some of the roads on the edge there. So that would allow not only public access, but would remedy some past issues as far as a lot of these roads did not allow easy fire fire engine access. There wasn't a good turnaround. There were private roads that were narrow. And so by creating a bit of a drive in here that was accessible would help the overall community. But I think there are a number of scales that are important from the homeowner on up to these, you know, kind of state level conversations that all of those barriers are somewhat blurred right now in Paradise. And I think we're looking at some solutions that I think pre-fire would have been impossible to consider.
You know, Molly and I were talking during the break about, you know, it's been just over a year since this fire. And, you know, there is, when you have that level of trauma and loss, there is a kind of PTSD, whatever you want to call it, a lot of psychological remnants of this disaster. And yet you're making these big decisions during that period. How do you factor all that in, the way people are feeling, you know, and decisions that are going to perhaps impact them for a very long time?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, part of our effort right now is kind of that community healing. We're actually hosting a meeting on Monday with organizations that are helping in the healing process for youth, but also to address kind of healing the healers. So that there are folks that have been very interested in the rebuild and helping out. And I think as we move forward, you raise an excellent point that we need to have not only people's immediate needs taken care of, but that they're in a position to where they can think far enough ahead. And that is a challenge right now.
Yeah.
However, I think part of what I think the Parks and Rec District can do, you know, we don't normally think of a district in this way, is we're providing a little bit of a vision, and we're getting a positive feedback from community members that have thought along the same lines. And so I've been a little bit bolder on proposing some of these ideas and peppering the community with parks, because we did have people shelter in parks and during the fire, and that probably saved their lives.
Molly, before we go to calls, anything you want to add to that?
Just that these decisions, I talked to people in Montecito where there was a debris flow that was caused by fire. 23 people died there. And I talked to people about this process that they've had in Santa Barbara. They had the T, the Jesusita, the Gap, the Zaca fire, the Thomas fire in 10 years, repeated fires. And they talked about the difficulty of making big decisions in that immediate aftermath and the need for better planning so that those decisions are easier.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And let's begin with Rob in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you. One of the things that often happens is the Forest Service and the CAL FIRE have to make a really big decision on whether to protect a town that's on the interface or save the forest itself. We've been involved in a couple of massive wildfires where they had to protect a small town that ended up being saved, but they put so many resources into this town that 150, 200,000 acres of forest land went up in flames. They couldn't spread enough resources around, and that forest is never going to come back in our lifetime. But these people's homes, everybody wants to save their home and their families, pets, and possessions, and nobody wants to put people in danger, but it puts the firefighters in a really difficult position on saving a forest that will be gone for a lifetime or protecting homes.
Timothy Inglesby, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I dispute that fighting fires actually saves a forest, because most forests in California evolve with fire and absolutely require fire at a certain frequency and intensity to maintain their ecological integrity, maintain the biodiversity that really depends on fire. It is, the caller is right. There's hard choices, and in most cases, firefighters, you know, prioritize property, but rightly so, because homes cannot burn, but most forests must burn. So we should get our priorities straight. And the future really is managing fire in wildlands, steering it, not stopping it, allowing it to go into areas that really require fire, to just recycle all the dead down material and turn them into soil nutrients, but steering them away from homes and communities that are highly vulnerable and cannot burn.
Molly?
Something we're talking about, and Max Moritz at UC Santa Barbara talks about this, is this idea that we need to be accustomed to fire the way we're accustomed to heavy storms, that it's something that can pass over us you know, towns and the forest and safely, and we can be safe in that repeated event, and then we can be ready for it. That's an idea about resilience, this idea that we can survive these things in the future.
All right, Rob, thanks very much for the call. Here's a tweet from Avi who writes, please discuss the fire implications of running power lines to remote buildings. Seems like those are very vulnerable and even dangerous. Can utility companies refuse to serve remote or high-risk areas, Molly?
Well, we're starting to see that in California, right? And that is kind of a form of, it's not physical retreat, we're moving people off of property, but if we can't safely serve those areas, we're starting to see that choice being made, and there's immediate consequences.
Off the grid, whether they like it or not. Yeah. All right, let's go to Shasta, which is a person, not a place. Shasta in San Francisco, welcome. Well, it's both, I guess.
Hi.
In this case, it's a person. Hi.
Hi. I really love what Molly just said about resilience and thinking of this like weather. I grew up in Paradise. I live in San Francisco now. My parents lost their home in the fire, and they also coincidentally were forest firefighters when I was very young. So I grew up very familiar with fire, and I feel like for a long time there was fires that weren't necessarily coming up to people's homes and stuff. And it was a natural thing in the summer to deal with and be aware of. So yeah. And I just wanted to call in and mention, like, it's the community aspect of this is what's really tough to like talk to propose that people shouldn't have the choice to rebuild. My parents have chosen not to.
They were
but
in Paradise.
They still are trying to figure Yeah, and they, but they're still trying to figure out how to like stay connected to the community while moving to a different town that's, you know, hours away. And, you know, I keep thinking about like this thing that it's like happened to everybody, because even the people on Chico who maybe weren't like, you know, didn't have something burned down, but yet, you know, are affected too. And it's like a lot of it's like, oh, what happened to them? And, you know, what are they going to do and stuff? But it's this whole systematic trickle down thing. You know?
Sure, yeah. And Dan Efsef, let me ask you, I mean, how are you, what are you hearing in that regard from people up there in Paradise, you know, trying to maintain connections in two places?
It is incredible to me how connected this community is. I've only been in this position for 2 years, but to have people, we had a Christmas tree lighting 1 month after the fire, and we opened our facility 1 week after they lifted the evacuation order. We had over 3,000 people come up, some as far away as San Diego and Southern California, other people from other states. And I'll have to tell you, it was a very emotional evening, but it was this positive emotion that people really love their community. They love their neighbors. They want to see good things happen in Paradise. And so I think we're trying to figure out how we can extend beyond our district boundaries to keep those people engaged, because I think Parks and Rec were an important part of people's lives up here.
All right, Shasta, thanks very much. Good luck to you and to your family as well. Here is a question from Brian, who writes, why is new construction with wooden roofs being allowed in the footprint of the fire? Dan, do you want to address that? Is that in fact true?
You know, that would be related to the town issues. I know that there are wooden roofs, you know, shake roofs are not on the menu anymore, and maybe that the planning guest can mention more about that. But I know that on the menu is metal roofs, composite roofs, and fire-resistant material. So they're trying to improve on the WUI standards that were here, even venting on attics.
Pete, do you want to add
anything? Predominantly construction in California are wood frame.
Yeah, Pete. Sorry.
Yeah, there's wood frame houses, but Dan's right that you have to have a combustion resistant roof, and a shake roof is not a combustion resistant roof. So you've got to have asphalt shingles or metal roof or something like that. And again, he mentioned the venting requirements. Those are really important because that's a major thoroughfare for embers to get into attics and foundations. And so when we redesigned our house, we redesigned it without any attic vents at all, just to avoid having that potential.
All right. We're talking about rebuilding in the aftermath of wildfire, and we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call if you'd like at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Let's go back to the phones and Doug in Kensington. Welcome.
Hi, yes. I'm with the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation, and we actually wrote a report on the subject of working from the home outward and how effective that is. So it's really exciting to hear your guests talk about the importance of that, because millions of Californians live next to fire-dependent ecosystems. My question is about the role of state funding in helping communities make those homes prepared to coexist with wildfire, making fire-safe homes. And I guess I'm surprised at this point that the state isn't putting more resources into it, whereas it is pouring a lot into projects about cutting forest out in remote areas. Right now, there's a project in the Rim Fire area that's using tens of millions of dollars that the state of California got from the Federal Housing Department, and it's using it to cut in remote areas. Wouldn't those resources be better used to help communities like Paradise rebuild in fire-safe ways, and other places where the houses are already built, making those fire-safe retrofits?
Molly Peterson?
I mean, I don't know that it's accurate to say that there's this huge, huge push into cutting down forests. We don't have a huge, huge push into doing a lot of things. The governor's budget, you know, there was a cut of $1 billion that was supposed to potentially go to things like retrofitting. So that's a broad range of tools. And I think in this conversation, what we're trying to address is this idea that resilience comes from a number of different options and sources.
All right. Anything you want to add to that, Pete Parkinson?
I think that's absolutely right. You've got to do it all, and there's an important element of being able to live with fire, like Molly mentioned earlier. I think is the fires are going to come, and we're going to have to manage the forests so that they can have the fires that they need to be healthy ecologically and environmentally, and that is going to naturally reduce the fire hazards.
All right, Doug, thanks very much. Let's go now to Mountain View. Oh, I'm sorry, Dan, did you want to jump in?
This is Tim, and I agree with a caller. There are a lot of very powerful voices calling for more, you know, cutting trees to save homes. And even that issue of, you know, logging forests, we're still fighting fires. As we speak, there are 5 hotshot crews pounding the ground on the Jordan Fire, which is in the Golden Trout Wilderness area, and which... you know, that was the site of the old McNally fire. Fire is what's recycling some of those down logs into soil. But right now we're trying to put out that fire because there is a remote possibility that some home or community far away might eventually encounter that fire later on. And that's just, you know, that's part of this puzzle here.
All right, let's go back.
You know, really should be working from the home outward instead of fighting the fires and wilderness inward.
All right, Erin in Mountain View, welcome. You're on.
Oh, it's Anne.
Oh, Anne, sorry.
Hi. I just wanted to push back a little bit and advocate for a much more holistic approach from Sacramento. I mean, you can say, yeah, we evolve with fire. These fires are going to come. But, you know, we didn't evolve with this kind of global warming. We didn't. California, where these fires start in the grasslands and stuff, that's all new as of 150 years ago. All these dry European grasses used to be native fescues that were green all year round. I mean, what do we do about that? I mean, when we're talking about fire planning, we're talking about one thing, and then you have the people who are talking about growth and about development, and they're completely disregarding safety. And if you bring up safety, you're treated like you're some kind of you know, underhanded NIMBY. And, you know, there needs to be some kind of, I mean, even growth within cities. We have earthquakes in this state. You're going to have fire if you have high density. We have to start bringing up these things about egress. If we're going to have fire, we have to worry about egress. We have to worry about building in fire-safe and earthquake-safe ways. We have to worry about all of these things, and maybe we need to have a kind of leadership from Sacramento that brings everybody together. I just don't see the constituency for it. There's no constituency for Safety First.
Molly?
You know, and I think it's a really interesting point where we talk to also communities that are taking steps, it matters into their own hands, and trying to be better stewards of their relationship to the land and their relationship to the forest and to the grasslands. I went to Trinity County, which has this really diverse landscape and ecosystem. It's forest and grasslands. There's chaparral there as well. So there's a lot of risk, but they want a healthiest possible landscape and they want a healthy community. And they are thinking very hard both about their building safety and about that seam, that wildland-urban interface. It's community conversation as well as a Sacramento conversation.
A lot of things to balance. Anne, thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Brian in Pleasanton. You're next.
Hi. I really want to push back on the whole conversation. You know, like people are talking about mitigating the fire risk and all this other stuff. And the reality is, we are in a new, unprecedented situation where climate change is affecting everything about the way we live. And until we have, elected officials and regulators talking about climate change as a reality, we need to mitigate that, and this, all the rest of it will be fixed. I just lost my home to a tornado on Memorial Day. 19 tornadoes touched down in Ohio in 5 hours. Over 500 tornadoes touched down in the last 2 months. The amount of hurricane. We can't just go around cleaning up. Need to be, you know.
Brian, you know, I think we have kind of not a great connection, so I think we're going to have to let you go. But I appreciate the what you're talking about. And, you know, Molly, it strikes me that listening to him that, you know, yes, there are all kinds of things affected by climate change, but we're also here, we are sitting on a fault line.
Right.
You know, building huge buildings in earthquake zones. So there are other kinds of risks that we're ignoring in some ways, too.
Well, and I think to the last two callers, what we're trying to talk about is this conversation about risk is made up of both the hazards, the natural hazards we're potentially vulnerable to, and the choices we make to respond to them, the systems we make. So there can be a greater emphasis on the systems we make and where the weaknesses are in that.
Exactly. Good point. All right. Let's go back to the phones again. It's 866-733-6786. And we go now to Tom in San Leandro. Welcome.
Hi. On a previous forum program, I heard that a lot of the golden grasses we see in the summer are not native species. So I just did a little internet research about native species that are still in some state parks. And they seem a lot more drought tolerant, as well as fire resistant. And what I'm curious about is efforts to regrow, you know, fire-resistant plants, not everywhere, because that would be a very, very large effort, but at least near towns and cities to help prevent, future fires as part of the effort you all are talking about from getting into the cities and towns in the first place.
Pete, you want to jump in on that one?
Well, a couple things. I think that, like somebody said earlier, I can't remember who now, the landscape in California wants to burn. That is the kind of a natural condition of the landscape in California, and that includes the grasslands as well. And so there may be grasslands that are less prone to burning, but they are going to burn on a pretty regular cycle. We know that oak woodlands in California want to burn on about a 20-year cycle, and it's not the oaks themselves that burn, but it's the grasses in there. And so we need to adapt to that kind of reality. That's at least what I mean when I talk about adaptation to the sort of fire regime that we have. But we can also stop making things worse by approving new developments in areas that are prone to fires and prone to more intense fires over the long term. So I think that if we start managing fires in a way that is compatible with ecological diversity, biodiversity in our forests, we're going to see fewer and less intense fires over time.
All right, Tom, thanks very much for the call.
I wanted to add something on that. One of the hats I wear is a restoration ecologist, and I've actually planted thousands of acres of native grasses. And the caller is correct that they are they tend to stay green longer. They're perennial, so they tend to stay green longer, have more underground biomass. But they do need that fire. And one thing that we're looking at as district is encouraging perhaps some ecological shifts to favor the native grasses, and then in some cases favor oaks over conifers. And so that may allow us to have a fire landscape that may have more frequent but less intensity fires, and to reduce fuels and manage it over the long haul.
Molly?
That's a form
of climate, that's adaptation.
Yeah, one place that we visited was Weaverville, where there's a community forest effort. You know, that's a place that there's been significant logging. They've had also significant fires in Trinity County. And in some places, they have these pines that are very close together, a very tight canopy. That's not historically what had been there before human intervention. And so what they're trying to do is find a way to enable those grasses that are in the forest floor to get the light that they need to thrive. And that's a really, really narrow, specific example of one place, but it shows you how complicated this is in California in all these different combinations.
And what does that entail, sort of trimming the canopy?
I mean, what they talk about is, first of all, they kind of thin, they do a little bit of this raking the forest. So
is that a Trump thing? Is that
what you're... I didn't want to think of it that way. But but they also talk about thinning the forest for risk. So they don't take old growth trees. They take secondary growth or tertiary growth trees to basically enable the other trees to get stronger and grow and thrive.
All right. Back to the phones. Deborah in Oakland, you're next. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Deborah Moore, and I work at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We have an office in Oakland, California. And I wanted to make a comment to help make people aware of a report that was delivered to the legislature last year. It's called the Climate Safe Infrastructure Working Group Report, Paying It Forward. And this was based on AB 2800, a bill that Union of Concerned Scientists sponsored a few years ago. And the purpose of this report was to put forward ways that climate science and climate risk can be better incorporated into infrastructure planning, design, and implementation to keep Californians safe from climate impacts. That includes fire. It includes other climate impacts, whether it's heat, drought, sea level rise.
And is the bill was signed into law, AB 2800, or...?
Yeah, it was passed in 2016, and the purpose of the bill was to bring together climate scientists, infrastructure engineers, California agencies to look at ways to change our planning process to keep Californians safe, specifically around infrastructure. And so that happened in 2016, and the working group met for 2 years and delivered its report last fall to the governor and to the legislature, and there are a whole variety of recommendations that we are hoping the new governor and administration will take up.
Okay, we're getting short on time. Pete, are you aware, Pete Parkinson, are you aware of that report?
I haven't seen it at this point.
I mean, Molly, so many reports get generated in Sacramento, you wonder sometimes whether who's reading them.
I mean, I think I'm sure those recommendations, it'll be interesting for us to follow up on them and see what happens with them. I know that infrastructure is a concern for all kinds of climate risk. I cover heat as well and urban heat and how that affects people. And I know this is a challenging problem, particularly here in San Francisco, where so many people died a couple of years ago.
Yeah. All right. Deborah, thanks for pointing that out to us. Here's a comment from Francis, who writes, Paradise is a very old town, back to the gold rush. There are many people who have strong roots there and many who can't afford to live elsewhere. Some of the most remote areas are populated by those with few resources. Dan, I mean, that must be something a lot of the folks up there are considering. It's like, where, now that they can't live there, where can they afford to go?
It is. Housing affordability and, displaced people, where are they now, is a great concern. And I know that a lot of the planning efforts, what they're concerned about, is that idea of some of these improvements may cost people out of the local market. And I do believe that there's some new approaches that could be enabled, such as maybe, you know, clustering homes a little closer together in some cases to where they can share some infrastructure and defensible space, sharing that resources. But it's definitely a challenge, I think, for our community, because we did have a lot of, you know, homeowners that relied on that affordable housing that was just part of the landscape here.
Here's another comment from Mark, who writes, outlying development remains the preferred way to bring housing to the Sacramento area because the land speculators make enormous profits and can develop the least suitable land. California may pretend these issues are not real, but pretend and extend won't solve these longstanding problems. And Pete Parkinson, coming back to what you wrote in that article, I mean, there are a lot of pressures on local planners from developers sometimes, and some of them are, you know, sort of speculators.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a bill in the legislature right now from Senator Jackson down in Santa Barbara, SB 182, which takes the sort of guidance principles that Molly talked about earlier in terms of the state's guidance to local governments about planning and puts some actual teeth in there so that you have the Department of Forestry and Fire Protection not only providing consultation to local governments, but actually providing an oversight level of review to the decisions that they're making about hazards in different areas.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time, as the music indicates. Thanks so much to all of you, Molly Peterson, for being here and for all your great reporting. Also to Dan Efseff, District Manager for the Paradise Recreation and Parks Department, Pete Parkinson from Sonoma County, and Timothy Inglesby from the Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in today for Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.